Right. Okay, so Monday, yesterday, was the 10th of Shvat. And as David was just talking about before, there's a special discourse relating to this day. The thing about the 10th of Shvat being that it was the day in 1950 that the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe passed away. And therefore, as a consequence, one would imagine automatically that that was the day the next Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, succeeded to become the seventh Rebbe. In fact, he held back from that in certain ways until a year later. On the 10th of Shvat 1951, he led a Hasidic gathering and, as it were, formally accepted the role of being Rebbe.
Why was that?
Why did he hold back from it? I think because he saw the previous Rebbe as the Rebbe. And he, together with his brother-in-law and the other major Hasidim, they will all help further the work of the previous Rebbe, which had basically been set up in the direction of outreach and strengthening Judaism in all forms and teaching of Hasidic ideas and teachings with the goal of bringing the Messiah. So the whole package was there before, in the lifetime of Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, the previous Rebbe. And so he felt that that could just continue, and he would help it along. But, you know, he could be the head of the committee, but he wouldn't be Rebbe as such. Now, some of the Hasidim didn't see it that way at all. They thought that he very much was the Rebbe. And there was an older Chassid who came and talked to him and tried to persuade him to be Rebbe, and there were other Hasidim who campaigned among the Hasidim that they should recognize him as the Rebbe. And so in 1951, on the 10th of Shvat 1951, he consented to this process.
But was there anybody else who could have taken over?
Well, in theory, there was his brother-in-law. I mean, that's one possibility, the Rashag. Mm. Who was Reb Shmaria Gorari, so who was actually older than him and married to an older sister. There were two surviving sisters. His one was married to the Rebbe Chaim Musya, and one was married to Reb Shmaria Gorari Chana, and she was older than Chaim Musya. So in theory, Reb Shmaria Gorari could have been the Rebbe. The consensus of the Hasidim focused on the Rebbe, and there was a particular individual very much campaigned for the Rebbe, called Rabbi Benzion Shem Tov, Zichron Debracha, whom I had the good fortune, the source, to know personally. He set up Lubavitch in London as well. And in quite a number of other places, very, very active person, like a dynamo. And he saw very clearly the Rebbe as the Rebbe, you know, in that time when there was uncertainty. In Israel, there was a strong movement quite early on that the Rebbe should be the Rebbe. Not in some other places. However, but eventually, the Hasidim were carried in seeing him that way, and then he finally consented himself. And he the interesting thing, particularly relating to this evening, is the way that he consented. Because when the previous Rebbe passed away, the last few years of his life, he could not speak clearly. He was very unwell, and one had to be able to understand what he was saying. Not that many people could understand what he was saying. And so instead of speaking discourses, ma'amorim, in public, he would write them. And they would be published, and the Hasidim would study them. So for a particular festival, he would publish a discourse. Even to read his handwriting was difficult, because he had to have a very soft pencil, and he wrote in a very, you know, like very small movements of the fingers. You had to be able to read, you know, that was also a feat, to read. And it was the Rebbe, actually, who read his handwriting, and the Rebbe was in charge of publishing. Before he was Rebbe, he was in charge of the three organizations of Lubavitch. There was Kohot, which is a publishing organization, publishing books, like books of Hasidic teachings. An organization called Merkoz Le'inyoni Chinuch, Center for Educational Issues, which was an outreach organization and which published many things in English. Kohot published things in Hebrew and Yiddish. Merkoz published things in English for outreach purposes, including things like charts of the Holy Land and where the 12 tribes lived in the Holy Land, and a chart, like educational material of all kinds. So that was Merkoz. And Machane Israel, which was a kind of a spiritual, it was a spiritual club, in a sense. People would learn Mishnah by heart, people would say Tehillim. It was a kind of an international club with a spiritual focus. So those are three organizations that the Rebbe was in charge of during the 1940s, once he got out of Europe and he came to America. His brother-in-law, Rav Shmaria Gerari, was in charge of the yeshiva. So that was the way things were divided at that point.
What was his secular degree in chemistry?
Electrical engineering.
Electrical engineering. How did he come to that?
Why did he choose that?
Yeah, and how? Because it seems he never left. I mean, and why was there the tradition that he should study something like that?
The previous Rebbe wanted him to study in university.
And to understand what a university was, a secular one.
Well, that's the thing. He said to the previous Rebbe, I can study the same material without going to a university. I can buy the books and read them at home. So the previous Rebbe said, no, I'd like you to go to a university, to be in a university. So when he was in Berlin, he and his wife were living in Berlin, he took courses. Or he attended courses.
Sorbonne.
Well, there were several periods. First of all, he was in Berlin till 1933, or a little bit later as well, I think. He was there in Berlin, attending courses in Berlin University. Then when they moved to Paris, he attended courses in a number of universities. So he attended courses at the Sorbonne. The Sorbonne teaches philosophy and languages. It doesn't teach science. But he attended courses there. He had a great interest in, or he felt that that was part of what the previous Rebbe wanted him to do, and he attended those courses.
Who did he study with? Did he study at all with Sartre or with Emmanuel Levinas?
I never heard that said, and I didn't. I didn't.
Did he affect Levinas or?
Not that I know. Levinas certainly never mentions him, as far as I know. No one's ever come up with a quote from Levinas. But he also took courses in somewhere called École Polytechnique, which was a science college, and he enrolled in another college, where he actually enrolled, not just like going to a course. See, the Sorbonne, anyone can walk in. It's like Oxford.
Yeah.
You know, you can just walk into a lecture and listen. But he enrolled in another university, a new university, where, like a kind of polytechnic, where he enrolled and actually took a diploma in electrical engineering. And it is said that when he came to America, he did some work for the US Navy as part of his private war effort, as it were, doing some kind of work. And the fact that he had a diploma in electrical engineering qualified him for doing something within that. So, I don't know exactly what he did. The diploma, an academic from Israel, Professor Menachem Friedman, did a lot of work chasing around to find out exactly what academic qualifications the Rebbe had, and he printed a picture of the Rebbe's diploma, so, which he found some. So that was, I know when, for myself, when it came a certain point in my life when I wanted to be in contact with a Hasidic Rebbe. And my family in Israel are Gera Hasidim. And I, in fact, saw the Gera Rebbe many times. And my family asked me, would you like to have a private meeting with the Gera Rebbe? This was the Beis Yisrael, a very famous figure in Israel around 1970. And I did not feel that the Gera Rebbe would see where I was coming from. You know, I was involved in university, I was in many different aspects of my life. I didn't feel that he would understand. When it came to a matter of considering the Lubavitcher Rebbe, whom I have no family connection with whatsoever, the Hasidim in my family are Ger and Alexander. Ger, like, it's all in my mother's family. One side Ger, the other side Alexander. Different types of Hasidism. But when it came to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he's been to university, I felt he would understand me, as it were. Now, I'm quite sure he would have understood me if he hadn't gone to university. But it was like a green light as far as I was concerned. You know, it made me think that he would understand. That's, So there he was then in America running these different organizations, and then came the previous Rebbe with the Rebbe worked very hard at with the Rebbe through the Rebbe worked very hard at creating an outreach concept of Lubavitch which would reach Jews around the world. And in fact, I have a report on the activities of the Merkoz L'Inyonei Chinuch, the Center for Educational Issues, which was published around 1948. And I've shown pictures of this in conferences because it's got a map of the world. And from New York, where Merkoz L'Inyonei Chinuch, where this center is located with the previous Rebbe, it's got arrows going to all the different countries where there is some kind of reach of this educational organization. So one place they've set up a school, another place they've set up there's a person who is doing teaching, another place they send educational material. At that point, it was a skeleton of what it became today, where it's a global movement with institutions, organizations in virtually every country of the world. But at that point, it was just the skeleton of what was forming. But it was all there in 1948 as the skeleton of what it was going to be in a very, very interesting way. So then the previous Rebbe passed away, and the Rebbe's way of conducting himself was as if the previous Rebbe was still, his teachings are still effective, and one simply has to go on with the teachings of the previous rebbe. But then people said they want him to be a rebbe. And it's interesting the way in which he accepted this, because the previous rebbe had published this discourse to be studied on a particular day, the 10th of Shvat. The 10th of Shvat was the yahrzeit of his grandmother, called Rivka. So the discourse was in four sections, and there were five chapters in each section. So there was the first section was for the 10th of Shvat, the yahrzeit of his grandmother. The second section was for the 13th of Shvat, which was the yahrzeit of his mother. The third section was for Purim, and the fourth section was for the 2nd of Nisan, which is the day that Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak became Rebbe, and the Rebbe before him passed away. So that's the second. So those four dates. Now the first of the dates was the 10th of Shvat. So the first two discourses were published together, and they came out on the 10th of Shvat, or before. The 10th of Shvat was actually a Shabbat. So they were published for that Shabbat, that people should study them on that Shabbat. That Shabbat he passed away. So it was understood that these four discourses, which all one links into the other, all 20 chapters, that that is a final statement of the previous Rebbe to the world. In fact, when you examine more carefully these four discourses, they had first been taught by the previous Rebbe in 1923. That's when he first said this long, complicated discourse called Bati Legani, I've come into my garden. It wasn't called that, it didn't begin with those words when he first said it. It was called Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, on that very day. But it went into the subject matter of these 20 chapters. So he said it in 1923, and it was recorded by one of the students. Like he wrote it down, like a chozer, who was able to hear what the Rebbe said and then write it down. In 1939, I think it was again published in a slightly different form. And in 1950, it was again published, basically using the text which had been written down by this student in 1923, with a little bit, few changes. But it was basically there. The discourse was there. So this is the discourse that went. Now the previous Rebbe became Rebbe in 1920. So 1923 was the first time he said this discourse. He said it again in the middle of his time of being Rebbe at a very dangerous junction in the 1930s, and then again just before he passed away. So there's something extremely significant about this discourse in terms of the life and the vision of the previous Rebbe. The way that Rebbe Nachum Mendel, our Rebbe, accepted the position of being Rebbe was that in 1951, on the 10th of Shvat, he said that discourse. And by the fact of him saying that discourse, that was seen as him accepting the role of Rebbe. And saying that discourse, he said it elaborating on the first chapter of the 20 chapters. The next year, in 1952, he said the discourse again on the 10th of Shvat, elaborating the second chapter. And so on, year by year, for 20 years, each year elaborating the next chapter, and then he finished in 1970, so that was the 20th chapter. 1971, he began again, the Rebbe began again from the beginning. And so there are two volumes of the Bati Legani Ma'amorim. This, in English, is the original discourse by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. This Bati Legani Hasidic discourses by Rabbi Yosef Weishnerson of Lubavitch. This is the original Bosi Legani of Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, and also the first discourse of the Rebbe in 1951. So that's in this book in English. In Hebrew, this has, at the beginning of the book, this first volume, it's got the original discourse of Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, and then the rest of the book are the 20 or more than 20 discourses elaborating each of the chapters. Sometimes on the 10th of Shvat, he would say two discourses, or, you know, there would be one in the day, one in the, or if it was on Shabbat, one after Shabbat, things like that. So there are actually more than 20 discourses, but they are dealing with the 20 chapters of the original. So that's the first volume, ending in 1970. And then from 1971 onwards is the second volume. So again, you have there the a volume of discourses by Reb Menachem Mendel going through this original discourse, elaborating it chapter by chapter. So there are therefore two cycles. The only thing is that the second cycle did not quite complete itself, because the last one is in 1988 instead of 1990, because in 1988, shortly after the 10th of Shvat, on the 22nd of Shvat, his wife passed away. And after his wife passed away, he never again had a Hasidic gathering in the week, and there was not the same. He had a Hasidic gathering every Shabbat, but he did not say a Bati Lagani discourse in 1989 and 1990 or 1991. Instead, what he did was he edited some of the earlier discourses. Most of the discourses in these books are not edited. They are things that he said, but they were not edited by him. But in the last years of his life, he edited some of the early ones. And also at some points, he had edited some of them, but mostly they're not edited. Now, according to this reckoning, which chapter would be the chapter of the original discourse for this year, 2007? Can we work it out? Which chapter?
Not arithmetic, please.
Well, if it goes 1951 to 1970, 1971 to 1990, 1991 to 2007, it would be chapter 70. From 1 to 2007, 1991 to 2007, that's the 17th chapter. 1991 is the first chapter, so 2007 is the 17th chapter. So the 17th chapter was discussed previously in two different discourses by the Rebbe, one in 1967, from 1951 to 1967, and the other one in 1987. 1971 to 1987. So we have in front of us a discourse from 1987. So that is the one that I propose we try and study together this evening.
Exactly how many discourses are there? I mean,
well, they're collected.
No, I don't mean for each day, but I mean all the whole. Some of all the discourses given by the Lubavitcher Rebbe.
By all of them. Mm. It's several hundred books. There are 50 books of discourses by the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe.
The one you study.
Oh no, I studied the second. He published 10 books in his own lifetime, but there are many more that were not published by him, but they are his discourses, which have recently been published. The last few decades. There's about 20-30 volumes, 20 volumes maybe, of the discourses of the first Rebbe. It's quite a quantity, just these volumes of discourse. It's a very, very considerable quantity. Yeah, in the case of the Rebbe, it's something like I suppose, 15 volumes or something of discourses. There are also sikhot, talks, which are not discourses, which are in a different style and are much more voluminous. But there's quite a quantity of discourses.
And of course, all related, 2,000 years worth of discourses.
Yes, that's right. It's a funnel. It's a spiritual funnel for the teachings of the Bible, of the Mishnah, of the Talmud, of the Midrash, of the Zohar, of the Kabbalah, of some philosophical ideas, many philosophical ideas, flowing through into these discourses. And David, who just saw, he was telling me about seeing this video of the Rebbe giving a discourse. So, what was it like? Can you explain to Judith?
It was amazing. It was like he was talking, and the thoughts were just coming into him. He had his eyes closed. It was a long discourse, an hour and a half or something like that.
I went with a friend in Johannesburg.
And it's just flowing through.
So when you went, you saw it was like with a big screen.
Yeah.
That was probably right. So that began around 1982,
it was in the 80s.
Yes. Of being able to have simultaneous video, because that was a simultaneous video thing to the sort from it.
I remember it was quite late at night.
Speaking in Yiddish.
My friend speaks Yiddish very fluently. It was Hebrew also.
Yeah, but he gave the discourses mostly in Yiddish.
Yeah, when he spoke in Yiddish. When they were transcribed, they would be transcribed in Hebrew, the discourses. All right, so we have in front of us, in English, we've got the couple of pages, the first two pages in English, of the original discourse by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. And on the back of that page, there's one page of chapter 17 of the original discourse by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. So, here it's printed on the back. So, just to give an idea of what the original discourse is, if you want to read that at home. But what we're actually going to focus on now is the discourse by Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, which was said in 1987 on the 10th of Shvat. And it's not an edited discourse, but it is published in this second volume of the Bati Ligani discourses. Now, in fact, this discourse in 1987 was probably not said with a melody. However, we will sing the melody proceeding with this. Oh ya ya ba ya ya yo ya mo ha ya ram ba ra yo ba mo ha ya ba ya ba ya ya ba mo ha ya ram ba yo ya ram ba Yam bum bum, ha yam bara yam bum bum, yam ba yam ba yam ba yam ba yom, ha yam ba yo yam bum bum, aho ya yam ba yam ba yom. Ha yiridamba yamba yam, ha yiridamba ho Right. Okay. So let's get into the discourse. And okay. Bati legani achoti kala. I've come into my garden, my sister, my bride. This is a verse from the Song of Songs, chapter 5. I've come into my garden, my sister, my bride, who may be bezer bal ha'elula b'mamol, and the person whose yahrzeit it is, that means Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, quotes regarding this in his discourse. Shehotziva natan al manat lilmod b'rabim b'yom yisalkuso, which he published and gave in order to be studied in public on the day that he actually passed away, Yud Shvat Tavshin Yud, the 10th of Shvat, 1950, he quotes there the Ita b'Midrash Rabba Sheashirim Rabba, that it says in the Midrash, the song, there's a Midrash Rabba on the song, there's a Midrash Rabba on each of the five books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Bereshit Rabba, Shmot Rabba, and also on the five Megillot. So there's a Song of Songs Rabba. B'Mekomo, and he says there in the relevant chapter, that what does it say, Bati Ligani, I've come into my garden, Legan ein k'tiv kan, it doesn't say to the garden, or a garden, a legani, but to my garden. What does my garden mean? The Midrash says liganuni. Now that's an interesting word, which may well relate to the word Genesis. To lemakom shahaya ikari betchila, to the place which was my source at the very beginning. And who is speaking? God is speaking. And God is saying, I've come into my garden, into my original place. The Ikar Shechina b'tachtonim haita. Because at the beginning of the creation, the essence of the Shechina, the essence of the Divine Presence, was in the lower world. Ba'olam hazeh tachton, in this lower world, this world here. That's in the Garden of Eden. When God created the world, there's the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve are in the Garden of Eden. And the Divine Presence is with them. And that Divine Presence is the essence of the Divine Presence. So that means the world was created in such a way that it should be a dwelling for the Divine Presence.
That's like the Yishrosh of Ruach last week.
Right.
That's what you do in a garden.
Making things grow.
Yes, but you will when you are in your desire.
Ah, right. Okay, right. All right. There have been many discussions by...
It was last week's discussion that you...
Yeah, I think you're right. There were many talks by the Rebbe, or some talks, where he just analyzes these first few words, the idea of the world being a garden, and the concept, a very positive way of looking at the world. The essence of the world is that it's a garden. A garden meaning a very positive place. The trouble is, that's concealed at this point. Yes, the world as it looks, does not look like a very positive place in many parts of the world, or in many situations in life. And that is not the way the world is supposed to be. This perspective is that the world is supposed to be a totally beautiful and harmonious place where the divine is revealed. And if it's not that, then it means there's something wrong. That, and so therefore we have to put it right. There you have the Kabbalistic concept of tikkun, of repair. There's something, there is an ideal, a beautiful ideal which is broken, which is somehow needs repair, and we, living in the world, have to repair it. So it's va'acha kach hayu kama inyanim bilti ritzuyim, and after that there were a number of things which were negative, undesired things. Sha'al yadam nistalka ha-shechina, through which the Shechina, the Divine Presence, departed higher and higher. And that means the Shechina went to higher and higher levels away from the world. Now, if we can just skip this bracket, which goes on for about four lines, and comes to the next line, the al yedei chet harishon, that through the first sin. Now, the word sin is a very heavy word in English. And he says here, chet lashon chisaron. The word chet in Hebrew, the normal use of the word is meaning a sin, as we would say in English. But the actual meaning of the root is to lack something. A sin means lacking something. And
I heard a talk by Robert Noach Weinberg, I think.
Right.
I think he said it means missing. It's like chatat et amatora.
Yes.
And like, you know, when shooting, you miss the target.
Absolutely, yes. So, for example, there's a verse in Tanakh which describes people who are able to shoot an arrow on a hare, v'lo yechata, and not miss. And the word yechata means that root, chata, means miss. So it's like missing something, which can also mean lacking something. Yeah, it gives a...
direction.
Sorry?
It's lacking concentration and direction, and again from last week, that a man is complete in his desire.
Right.
And I was thinking of Zen and the art of archery, where it takes a long time until you're absolutely concentrated on the target to let go. And the arrow reaches the target only because you're not trying to reach the target. You're letting go. It's almost the target draws you, the arrow, to it. Mm. Same concept, I think.
Now, there's another verse in the Bible. Va'ani u'beni Shlomo chata'im. I and my son Solomon. Solomon's mother is saying this, Bathsheba. She's saying this to King David. I and my son Solomon will be lacking. You see, chata'im. She uses the word chata'im, meaning lacking. That's the reference down here in the footnote. So, as a result of this missing, this lack, this deficiency, this sin, in a simple way of understanding it, sin means obscuring of the divine desire. So using your concept of desire, that there is the will of God, that things should be done in a particular way. And if that will is not carried out, then it's a kind of a concealment of godliness.
Isn't it chatzo? I've forgotten the exact words, but the translation was something a man's.
Chefetz. Yes. So there is the a concealment of the divine presence, or the divine presence moving away from the world, being hidden from the world, not being apparent in the world. And there is this idea that through the first problem, which was eating from the tree of knowledge, nistalka shechina me'eretz lirakia rishon, the shechina departed from being on ground level, as it were, to the first firmament. And after that, through further levels of sin described in the Bible, Cain killing Abel, and similar things like that, one by one, the Shina departed from firmament to firmament, milamata lamaila, going higher and higher away from the world. Achnit kaptsu shiva dorot shelo lemal yuta. Until there were seven generations, one after the other, in a negative way, Shal Yadam Nistalkash Shinam Elamata Lamaila Adveleki Ashvi, until you have the Shinah at the seventh firmament and not in the world, very far from the world. And the world was a realm of hiddenness of God and total idolatry. People had forgotten God, everyone, except one or two individuals, but almost everyone had completely forgotten the idea of God. That's how Abraham was brought up, in a world where the concept of God did not exist. And after that arose seven tzaddikim. Each one of them drew the divine presence from above downwards a little bit. Avram brought the Shekhinah from the seventh firmament to the sixth, and after Avraham came Yitzchak, and after Yitzchak came Yaakov, and after Yaakov came the generation of his children, such as Levi. And Levi had a son called Kahat, and Kahat had a son called Amram, and Amram had a son called Moshe. So Moshe is the seventh. Ad Sheba Moshe Shu Ashvi, till Moshe came, and he was the seventh. And there is a principle that's expressed in the Midrash, also in Midrash Rabbah, in Vayikra Rabbah. V'chol Ashviin Chavivin, all sevenths are precious. Everything which is seventh, the seventh day, the seventh year, the number seven has a spiritual connotation. And the fact that this is the seventh generation, the seventh tzaddik, Moshe Rabbeinu, counting from Abraham, he had an extra power, and he was v'horhidah mirakia arishon la'aretz. He drew the divine presence down from the first firmament until it was finally in the world. This means, in this very step, going from the first firmament to the world, how you come a yiridot, there's several different levels of this, bringing it down into the world. Till he brought the Shekhinah, he revealed the Shekhinah here in this physical world. Now, in which way and how do we see the Shekhinah being in the physical world? Therefore, specifically to Moshe was given the command, Hatzivui, Va'asuli mikdash v'shechanti b'tocham, make for me a sanctuary, God says, and I will dwell within them. Shezeu inyan yiridat ha'shechina lamata ba'aretz. This is making the sanctuary and the descent of the divine presence below into the world to be there in the sanctuary. Shaharei, now, why is the Mishkan, the sanctuary, part of the world? Shaharei ha-Mishkan nase minyanim olam davka. The sanctuary is made of physical things. Kmo shekatuv b'rosh parashat Truma, as it says at the beginning of Sedra Truma, which we'll read in a few weeks' time in the Torah, v'yikchu li Truma, take for me an offering, v'zot ha-Truma, this is the offering, zahav v'chesev v'nochoshet, gold, silver, copper. Shezeh kolel kol advarim amanuyim sham. There's a whole list of types of subject of substance there. Shemehem naaseh hamishkan, from which the sanctuary was made. It goes on to the back. V'diku chazal, and the sages, such as the Alshech and the Shloh, they comment on the fact that it doesn't say betocho lo nema, it doesn't say I will dwell in it, make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell in it, eile betocham, make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell in them, which the Alshech explains and other sages after him, betoch kol echad ve'echad miYisrael, within each individual Jew. That is what the sanctuary is. The sanctuary, that's where the divine presence is dwelling. There's the sanctuary in Jerusalem where the divine presence is there in the Holy of Holies, that infinitely holy spot which only the high priest could enter once a year on Yom Kippur. And also there is the divine indwelling within the heart of each individual.
with nomadism, meeting settlements also, and the shape of the hay, and Shechem, I mean in the land itself.
Right.
And why they went to Shechem, and that whole thing is a parable of the settled and the nomads.
Well,
their meeting.
It's a very interesting thing just in terms of the Mishkan, because the Mishkan originally was a
pelvic area.
The Mishkan, the sanctuary, was portable. They would put it up at a particular place in the desert, in the Sinai desert, and that's where they built it, at the foot of Mount Sinai. And then they would put it down, and they carried it somewhere else in the desert, and they put it up again, and so there is the Mishkan. And there were 40 years or 38 years of journeying through the desert, and each place they came to, they would put the sanctuary up, they would set it up. And then when they came into the land of Israel, they set it up in several different places before it came to Jerusalem. Once it came to Jerusalem, that was its permanent place. And so from the sanctuary, it then became the stone temple that was built in Jerusalem. But there was a shifting sanctuary, and then the final unity and fixed locus in Jerusalem itself. At the same time, as you say, there's the individual Jew. Now the place, the locus of the individual Jew, on the one hand, is Israel, the land of Israel, Jerusalem, the whole Jewish people coming to Jerusalem. But on the other hand, there's the individual Jew who is everywhere in the world, and might be in any place in the world. So you have this combination of the center which is in Jerusalem and the center which is in each person. And that's, in a way, the postmodern dimension, where each individual is the center. Each person is the center. It's not just that there's a center here and everywhere else is on the periphery, but each individual themselves is the center. Going together with what the Rambam says, very often quoted by the Rebbe, that the action of one individual can transform the whole world and bring the redemption, seeing the world as balanced, and one good action by one individual changes, or even one good thought, the Rebbe adds to the way that the Rambam, Maimonides, expresses it. Now here, in the last two lines of this paragraph, he connects the idea of this, the divine presence being revealed in the sanctuary in Jerusalem, and the way it's within each individual. Through the service of each person to make those physical things in the world, l'mishkan u'mikdash lo yitbarach, into a sanctuary and temple for God, al yedei ze na'ase v'shechanti b'tocham, through that comes the indwelling of the divine presence b'toch kol echad v'achat mi'Yisrael, within each individual Jew, man and woman. So in other words, it's the service to make the sanctuary, which in fact achieves the indwelling of the divine within oneself. So there is a sense of direction. That's the direction is to build the sanctuary. And that's the life of a person. That's the work. That's the labor of a person. And in fact, elsewhere in Hasidic teaching, it explains that's why we rest on Shabbat, why we don't work on Shabbat. Because the work of the 6 days of the week is in order to build the sanctuary. So whether a person is a therapist, or he makes violins, or he does something else, or he runs a garage, whatever it might be, that work is in order to build a sanctuary. That's the deeper level of what the person is actually doing. When it comes to Shabbat, the sanctuary is built. On Shabbat, it's as if the sanctuary, the temple, is rebuilt, it's there. So one doesn't have to work anymore, because the divine presence is already revealed. So we don't need any weekday work, any ordinary work, because now the sanctuary is there. Now, v'hine avodah zu d'hashchat ha-shchina lamata. Now, this idea of making the Shechina dwell below, yeshna gam b'avodah pratit d'chol echad b'chat Yisrael, is also there in the individual service of each individual Jew. V'tochan avodah zu nilmad mikumo shehaya b'mishkan kipshuto, and we learn the nature of this service from the way it was in the Mishkan, literally. Dichtiv Bey, of which it says, V'asita et hakhashin l'mishkan, you should make planks for the Mishkan. Atzei shitim omdim, planks of cedar wood, standing up, big planks, 10 cubits high. That was the basic structure of the sanctuary they built in the desert. Dihine keresh, now we have the word keresh. Keresh. Now, keresh is a plank of the Mishkan. Now, what word does that, what can we make that into, an anagram?
Sheker.
Sheker, that's right. Falsehood. So, the service of making the sanctuary is taking the sheker of the world and make the falsehood of the world and transforming it so that it becomes a plank of the sanctuary, revealing God. So we take something which is negative and we make it into something positive.
Our daughter can also read crash.
Yes. Okay, you have to have the right lekudot. There you are, you see. Take the crash and make it into a carrot. Yes.
Where's the roof beam?
That's right. Dihine keresh hu otiot sheker, because the word keresh, plank, is the letters sheker, falsehood.
And risk.
And what?
Risk.
Oh, risk, okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, sometimes you have to take risks in order to make the crash into a carrot.
Okay.
So, and the word sheker, the word falsehood.
Shekar. Very cold. Sorry.
Haromez la alma de shikra. The world of falsehood. Not just a falsehood, but a world of falsehood. A world where godliness is hidden, where values are topsy-turvy, where sheker hachin vehevel ayofi, false is grace, beauty, and vanity is beauty. Yeah, false is grace and vanity is beauty. So there's a talk by the previous Rebbe in which he explained...
That's right, isn't it?
What?
There's a lot of that today.
Well, he puts it, he says that people are calling the wrong thing graceful, and the thing which is actually worthless, vain and worthless, they call beautiful. So it's like upside down values, reversed values. Mm-hmm. So that's the alma de shikra, the world of falsehood. And the idea of making the Mishkan is that we transform the falsehood of the world, and we make from that the planks of the sanctuary. Now these planks are made of cedar wood, which is called Atzei Shittim, Shin Tet Yud Mem. Now this is why the wood is cedar wood, because this word relates to the word shtut, folly. The inyan asiyat ha-mishkan me'atzei shittim dafka, making the sanctuary out of this kind of wood, which has got a word relating to folly. Huma she'mahapchim ha-shtut de'lumat zeh, is that we transform the folly of the false aspects of life. Vo'osim imenu mishkan lo yitbarach, and we make from it a sanctuary for God. He explains at length in this discourse, in chapter 5, that there is a line of reason, and there is a kind of folly which goes below reason. And so that is impure folly, negative folly, right? Negative folly which goes below reason and leads to all kinds of problems. But there is also a positive folly which he calls stutdikdusha, sacred folly. Now, sacred folly means that the person does something beyond reason of a positive kind, an extraordinary love, which leads them to act in a way which goes quite beyond the ordinary categories of life. An extraordinary concern in some way for something, and the person does that in a way which goes beyond the line of reason. Now this, what's called mesirat nefesh, self-sacrifice, total dedication. Now this sacred folly, in a sense, is a kapara, redeems the negative folly. So there's negative folly in the world, but the sacred folly, which is within our hands to advance into, that is the kapara, that is what changes the world, that what transforms the whole nature of existence. What's the time?
Don't have a watch.
Ah. Thank you. Okay. And similarly, it's so in the service of each individual Jew. We have to transform the falsehood of the world and make the world into a temple for God, and to transform the false folly into sacred folly. As it says in the Talmud in Ksubot, it talks about dancing at a wedding. And there was a rabbi, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Yitzchok, who would dance in a very, very wild way, juggling. And he was like a famous rabbi, and the other rabbis were shocked at his the way he conducted himself. And then finally they saw that he was really doing right, that he was this was absolutely right what he was doing, because a wedding is something very sacred. When a husband and bride and groom get married, there is a beautiful, and in marriage throughout life with the help of God, there's a beautiful revelation of the divine, and his joyful, wild joy was really an expression of sacred folly in order to express the greatness of this spiritual union that was, and physical union that was being achieved. It's a way of serving God which goes beyond reason. Going beyond the limitations of reason. Until human reason calls such an activity stupid, folly. People said he was being stupid. It was folly what he was doing, but in fact it was sacred. And there are things that a person does sometimes which are right, and other people do not understand that that is right, that that is really the greatest and most important thing to do. And the ability to enter into that realm, that is a very important aspect of the independence of the individual, that they're able to go beyond the limitations of ordinary reason. And in general, this step into a higher realm and transforming the world is through studying Torah. Ki al yedei limud haTorah, because through studying Torah, mahapchim et haroshot harabim de'alma de'pruda, you transform the public thoroughfare of the world of separation, like your son was learning, David, about the idea of making something which is a Roshut HaRabim, which is a public thoroughfare, where you can't carry on Shabbat. And through the Eruv, or the Korah, or the different thing, making it into a Roshut HaYachid, into a private domain, where Yechido Shel Olam, the oneness of the world, God, is able to dwell. You see, that's our general attempt, that there is a world of separation, a public thoroughfare, a public domain in a negative sense, and we are seeking to make it Urshut HaYachid LiYechido Shel Olam, a realm of unity, like what is called technically a private realm, personal realm for the realm of God. The world in itself is like a public thoroughfare. The nasaf apart from the fact that it looks like a public thoroughfare, as regards quite a number of Jewish laws, it has the law of being a roshut harabim. V'al'yedei limud haTorah, and through studying Torah, she'akadosh baruch hu yichnis et atzmo b'Torah k'biyachol. God, so to speak, put himself inside the Torah. Kamama, as the saying which explains the word anochi. Anochi is the first word of the Ten Commandments. And that word, anochi, can be an anagram. Ana, I, nafshi, myself, katavit, I've written, yahavit, I've given. Naaseh, I give myself to you. And when you're learning Torah, God says, I am here with you. Naaseh roshut harabim l'roshut hayachid. Then the public thoroughfare becomes a private thoroughfare. Private for whom? L'yechido shel olam, to the God, the oneness of the world. V'al'yedei avoda b'chol inyanim elu, and through our service in all these matters, הרי כל אחד מישראל בונה את הבית המקדש הפרטי שלו. Each individual Jew builds his personal temple, or her personal temple. וכן את בית המקדש הכללי, and also the general temple, the temple in Jerusalem, בכלל ישראל, for the whole Jewish people, וכל העולם כולו, and for the whole of humanity. מקדש אדני כוננו ידיך. The temple of God which your hands make. So by building our own temple, we are making the temple in Jerusalem for all, for the whole Jewish people, for the whole of humanity. Apart from the fact that the service of each individual in general brings the future redemption, ubinyan beit hamikdash hashlishi, in the building of the third temple, וכמו שכתב הרמב״ם, as the Rambam wrote, שעל ידי מעשה אחד, through one action, מכריא את עצמו, one tips, oneself, ואת כל העולם כולו לכף זכות. And the whole world, one tips it to the side of merit. וגרם לו ולהם תשועה והצלה, and one causes for oneself and for the whole world, salvation. כולל בפשטות ההצלה הכללית על העשית. Which includes the idea of the salvation of the future, the redemption. Hine od zot, in addition, shekasher ha'avodah hi b'limud ha'Torah, when the service is through learning Torah, hare om razal, the sages said, d'mishecharav beit ha'migdash. The sages tell us in Brachot that when the temple was destroyed, ein lo la'hakadosh baruch hu b'olamo. God only has in his world Eladalad Amot Shel Halacha, the four cubits of the law. In other words, the study of Torah itself is a revelation of God within the world. That when we are studying Torah, whether it's the Halacha or whether it's another aspect of Torah, as we're doing this minute, when one is studying Torah, at that moment there's a revelation of the divine. We can understand from this, through study of Torah, is brought about the idea of I will dwell within them, kipshuto, literally, in the four cubits of halacha, of study of the law of the Torah, the teachings of the Torah. Although there is a particular emphasis on halacha in itself, and that's one of the reasons why the Rebbe emphasized the study of the Rambam, Mishneh Torah, or Sefer Mitzvah, because in the Rambam you have all the halachot of the Oral Torah. V'chol zeh u'akdama v'hachanak chovah d'binyan beit hamikdash hashlishi. All this is a preparation for the building of the third temple al yidei Mashiach Tzidkenu, through Mashiach b'mheiru b'yameinu mama, speedily in our days. So all that is this avodah, this task of man. Now, what this goes on to say, is that there is a battle going on. And the nature of this battle, the Jewish people are called Tzivot Hashem. In last week's Sedra, the Jewish people are called Tzivot Hashem, the army of God, as they left Egypt. And we're now in the next Sedra, speaking about as they have just left Egypt, and they're going towards the Red Sea, and there's going to be the splitting of the sea. But this term, the Tzivot Hashem, the army of Hashem, the armies of Hashem, there's a battle which is going on. And this battle is the battle in order to transform the world of falsehoods. And the world of falsehood has many negative forces, as it were, of different kinds, which are within us, which have to be transformed. And so a person, an individual, might have an enormous battle facing him or her in this personal attempt to transform the world of falsehood into a world where the divine is revealed. And the king gives his treasure to the people, the soldiers, in the battle. Now, when there's a battle, in literal terms, so you have the army at the front, and from the center of the country, from Whitehall, wherever it is, they have to organize supplies, arms. Everything has to be given over to the troops. And there is the image here of a king who has a very, very special treasure in his palace. A treasure which has been hidden away for many generations that no one has been able to see. And now, because of this battle, which is a final battle, it's an ultimate battle, because the quest to transform the world of falsehood in totality into a world of goodness and truth and purity and holiness, that's a final battle, that's an ultimate battle. The king opens the innermost treasure house within his palace and reveals this treasure and gives it over to the soldiers in the army. And we are the soldiers in the army, and God is the king. And the treasure that God is revealing is the deepest aspect of the Torah. And it's that deep aspect of the Torah, those mayanot, those fountains of the inner dimension of the Torah, that which was concealed for many, many generations. When it was in the Zohar there were for 1,000 years, the Zohar was hardly known by anyone. And then when it began to be known, then there were arguments about it, and there were restrictions on who should learn it, and the different ideas around it. And then came the Baal Shem Tov, who said, as the result of a very special spiritual experience that he had, that Mashiach told him, he asked Mashiach, when will you come? He had an ascent of the soul to a higher realm. And he asked Mashiach, when will you come? And Mashiach said, when your fountains burst outwards to those who are outside. And the fountain.
We have Madonna reading
Zohar. All right. And so these are the fountains, and that is the inner treasure. That is the inner treasure which the king is given.
Top of the pops.
Hmm?
And Matityahu, top of the pops.
That's right. That's right. And the king is giving this inner treasure to us, that we are able to learn these spiritual teachings, and through that we build our own personal temple, and through that we build the general temple in Jerusalem. And that is the theme of this discourse. And in fact, chapter 17 talks about the exalted nature of the where this treasure comes from. And there is a, just go back to that second page over there where it has it in English. There is a passage in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. Ad shelo nivra ha'olam hayuhu shmo levad. Before the world was created, only he and his name existed. And what the discourse does is it explores this concept, he and his name, and the nature of the divine name, and the way the name includes all, it's something incredibly spiritual in itself, but it represents revelation. Whereas he and his name, he is something which is higher, beyond revelation, so a much more exalted level. And that much more exalted level of godliness, which is there in the inner dimension of Torah, in Pnimiyuta Torah, the inwardness of Torah, the teachings of the Kabbalah, and within the teachings of the Kabbalah, and beyond the teachings of the Kabbalah, are the Hasidic teachings of the Baal Shem Tov, which somehow reach right to the essence, to the point where everyone is united. You see, that's very interesting. The Kabbalah is for the elite, remarkable individual. Someone who is totally in command of themselves. Someone who is totally pure. Who has been able to get rid of every little bit of impurity and never has a bad day. That's the Kabbalist. But Hasidic teachings are for everyone. Even for people who have bad days of all different kinds. But nonetheless, there's the Hasidic dimension. You can suddenly recoup and transform the whole thing with a smile and a glint in your eye and seeing another dimension of it. That's the Hasidic perspective. And so this is what is being given to us. You see, this Anochi, this God giving everything. So what happens at the giving of the Torah? There were the laws of the Ten Commandments. That's the revealed Torah. And all the explanations in Sedra Mishpatim, which comes after that, you know, civil law. But there was also the thunder, the lightning, the sound of the shofar. That's like the inner dimension of the Torah. And that, which was there at Mount Sinai. And that is translated into the spiritual teachings of Hasidut, of Hasidic teachings, so that we are able to study them. And around the world, people are able to do that now, and they do. And that's the most incredible thing. And that's the treasure, the inner treasure, which is taken from the highest level. There's a whole argument in Masechet Shabbat when it talks about God giving the Torah to Moshe. The angels complain bitterly. Why are you giving the Torah to these human beings? They're going to mess it up. They're not going to keep it properly. Keep your wonderful Torah in heaven. And there was this tremendous breakthrough of the giving of the Torah, and an even deeper breakthrough, the revelation within the Torah of this highest level, which is the hidden treasure of the Torah. And that is what we are given in order to help us build our own personal temple and to build the temple in Jerusalem for the whole Jewish people and for the whole of humanity with the coming of Mashiach.